This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability.
And will, to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Assalamu alaikum, everybody. Welcome to a long-awaited episode of the Hangout here at Qadim Institute. Yours truly, Abdulrahman Murphy, here with none other than Sheikh Abdul Nasser Jengda. Sheikh, what's going on?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Alhamdulillah, good to be back.
Alhamdulillah. So yeah, took a little hiatus.
It's been an interesting ride.
So recovering, there was, last time we talked about Aruba.
We did.
Your trip, and then I went for Umrah, took Qadim Umrah in the winter, which was...
That was amazing.
Yeah.
And then I had the Seerah intensive for 2 weeks.
Yeah. Mashallah.
So that was a lot of fun. Alhamdulillah.
So we're kind of going back and forth.
Yeah. So we had a busy winter break. And then after the winter break, just kind of getting back and getting settled back into the daily routine, with just the different responsibilities here at seminary, you in the community, and just getting settled back in. So we just needed to kind of find the groove again, find a spot where we could start doing the hangout. But alhamdulillah, also, obviously, everybody was kind of distracted, consumed, upset by the inauguration and everything that was going on. So
things leading up to it. Yeah. So I think, you know, Obama's, now that we're back,
Obama's 8,000 farewell lectures that he gave.
I know, seriously.
Kind of like, okay, we get it. You're leaving. Just
like
go away.
Kobe's tour.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be mean, but just, yes, you gave like, he gave like some big, gigantic farewell lecture in Ohio, in Chicago.
Yeah.
In Grant Park or something like that, where he gave his inauguration speech the first time around, or acceptance speech, and then. After that, I'm pretty sure I saw him give like 8 other lectures. So anyways.
Yeah. He was just on a tour. I think also people were, there was actually something that was very interesting that our good friend, Omar Muzaffar, chaplain, professor, cool guy at Loyola, he talked about like Obama and then the mythology of Obama. Mm. So he was saying that like, if you look at Obama and especially with the internet, there's like what we know of President Obama, meaning or former President Obama tier, which is like, you know, he had his policies that we appreciated and then some that people, not just Muslims, but everybody really didn't like. For example, you know, not only just foreign policy, but domestic policies on certain issues and stuff like that. Granted, politics is a hairy business, but he was saying that there's this mythology of Obama.
Yeah.
These representations of him. And particularly with Michelle, you know, they're just like incredible, like couple.
Like they basically made like saints out of them.
Yeah. And he's saying that like, if you look at the way that they're represented in terms of like marriage, people will share and be like goals and they'll write different things. And he's like, you know, he was just kind of, he wasn't trying to be like a negative Nancy, but he was saying like, they probably fight too.
Yeah.
Meaning like, you know, they're a normal couple. They probably have their issues. They are just really good at presenting themselves in a way that is amazingly looking.
It's part of the internet.
And so it's important. Yeah. And so it's important for us to be able to separate the mythology of Obama from Obama.
Yeah.
There are parts that definitely are appreciated. He was a classy dude.
Yeah.
He really, really was dignified, even though, you know, the way maybe he did things in office, things like Guantanamo, et cetera, et cetera. But you can't argue the dude was, he held himself together.
Just sandwiched in between George Bush, and now Donald Trump, he was obviously a very educated, very eloquent person.
Yeah.
So when you're sandwiched in between two idiots, you're just going to look good.
Yeah.
It's kind of like being a high scoring guy on a bad team.
Yeah, exactly.
Damian Lillard is a beast, but he also plays for the Portland Trailblazers.
Exactly. Or Russell Westbrook now, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was kind of an interesting point. But given, you know, and I think, you know, leading into our conversation about the presidential election, the inauguration, and the different things that led up to that, one of the reasons why I think people are struggling so much with sort of transitioning to Donald Trump is because of the mythology of Obama. And so people were so, you know, overtaken and obsessed by what he was like and how amazing it was and how incredible he looked. And oh my God, look at him and Joe Biden, best friends forever. And like, we love him. And it was cute, but the contrast, the relativity is also causing big issues. Cause now we're like, man, Donald Trump doesn't have a best friend. Like, I don't think anyone likes him.
Nobody,
you know,
likes
you saw the video of him with Melania and her kind of looking
so scary,
like she's being held hostage.
So scary.
Marital hostage.
Like, I was legit worried about like her just well-being in that moment.
It genuinely convinced me that she's a spy by Putin. And she's just like, how much longer do I have to do this?
Was this really worth it?
Yeah. So let's talk about that. The inauguration happened on Friday.
Yes.
Today is Tuesday, so it happened a few days ago. Where were you? What were your thoughts?
The inauguration, when it happened, where was I?
It was Friday. So it was...
Oh, it was a Friday, yeah. So I was at home. It was definitely, yeah, it was before Jumu'ah. I was at home. But yeah, I was just getting ready for Jumu'ah. Friday mornings when I'm not traveling or kind of a nice time, I get to just hang out with Mr. Muhammad in the morning and just kind of hang out. And but yeah, I was just at home just kind of minding my own business. I did kind of realize a little bit later Friday morning, later than I would have liked, that oh yeah, I'm actually going to have to address this garbage.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was just so set in my mind that look, we just got a huge fight and a task ahead of us right now. We're basically going to follow Coach Bernie Sanders, into the fight.
Waraka bin Nofel.
Yeah. Greg Popovich of the political world. Greg Popovich is pretty woke.
He's amazing.
He's woke, son.
He's lit.
Yeah.
Yeah. He keeps it lit.
He's keeping it real. But, so yeah, I was just like, you know, we just got a huge task and a fight ahead of us, you know, And so I was just kind of like blocking that whole inauguration situation out of my head. But then I realized while I am negotiating it for myself, but I also have the benefit and the privilege of, you know, kind of like talking to different people and being part of certain conversations that kind of gives me some clarity and gives me confidence about the task ahead. But the common everyday average Ahmed Zainab Muslim does not have that same privilege, is not in my position. So then I realized they're going to show up to Friday hoping to get that clarity and that confidence in the Friday khutbah. So then I kind of went into overdrive and I'm like, okay, let me formulate some thoughts here.
And you recorded that, and I think it's up on the podcast, right?
Yeah, yeah, so it's on the podcast. So I just basically talked about how...
What was the call, just so we know? Faith in action?
Faith in action.
Okay, yeah. I think, you know, Omar Zuffer also, I was talking on the phone with him the day before, because he's the chaplain of the university. And so I work with a lot of like university students. And so I'm always kind of pinging ideas off of him. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that like students were in his office crying.
Yeah.
You know, they were really emotionally distraught about, you know, it's almost like we know it's going to happen. But then the day before you're like, oh gosh. And so they were really, so I had a very similar realization that morning. I was going to give khutbah on a completely different topic. And then I was sort of just driving there and I was like, you know, I need to really rethink this just because I'm not being necessarily affected by it. You know, in the same way, doesn't mean that our community is not. And this is a sort of a mini lesson for all the students of knowledge out there, that it's important not to project yourself onto your community.
No.
Like, just because you like reading, you know, the poetry of, you know, so-and-so scholar, or you're reading fiqh issues on this and this, it doesn't mean that that's what the class should be about.
No. If I've been doing a deep dive recently about, like, financial contracts and acceptable conditions within financial contracts from a fiqh perspective, I can't just show up. Forget about in the khutbah. I can't even show up on Tuesday for the weekly community halaqa and then just launch into it. No, my weekly community halaqa, no matter what goes on here at the seminary or what I'm reading in my own free time, my weekly community halaqa is on the seerah of the Prophet ﷺ.
Mm-hmm.
And I only cover one thing per week, and I tell it more as a story than an academic analysis of all the narrations, right? I just told the story of Hatib bin Abi Balta'a, like, this is what happened, that's what happened, he felt like this, and then the Prophet handled it like that. Like, you have to understand your people have needs.
Yeah.
And it's like my children, right? My kids. If think about how irresponsible I'd be as a parent if, let's just say, I'm on a particular diet or whatever it is, but then I'm forcing my kids to eat the same thing that I have to eat due to my health restrictions, when they're just growing, nurturing, you know, young children.
Yeah.
They need like a really holistic, healthy, you know, diet. They need to be eating proper food. I'm an old man who's out of shape, so I need to get in shape. I'm on a diet, but I got to feed my two-year-old properly.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the big things we see, especially at conferences. Like, conference organizers, they'll choose topics based off of kind of what they think. I think one of the cool tactics I've seen recently is just like using Facebook to crowdsource your topics. And then the other cool thing, just a little pro tip here, is that increases your registration, because people who see what they suggested without even realizing, they're like, oh great, they're going to answer a question I've had for a long time.
Absolutely.
And now your conference is going to be both relevant and well attended, which is great.
Another thing, I mean, again, this is kind of niche advice, but just as a conversation, it's come up. Whenever you have Q&A sessions at a lecture or a conference or a seminar, all the note cards that have the questions on them, save them. And next time you are putting a conference together or you're looking for lecture topics, just design them around the questions that were asked.
That's a great idea.
And that's what happened when I developed the Firm Ground class I was teaching with Al Maghrib. That's what I basically did, was because it didn't matter what I was teaching the seminar about. It could have been tafsir, it was seerah, it was meaningful prayer, whatever it was, no matter what the topic was, it was QI or SI, Arabic or seerah. These were the questions that people are always asking. And eventually I just had to realize that, well, what's wrong with just answering their questions? And if everyone's asking you the same exact questions, no matter what you end up talking about, and I'm not saying you should only talk about the questions people have. There are some needs the community has. Like, I sit down, my son maybe just wants to drink, you know, soda all day long. But I realize at some point I got to say no and snatch the soda away, and I got to feed him proper food. So I got to understand that he just wants to drink juice all day long. I'm like, no, you got to eat your food. But similarly, we got to impart some knowledge and some education to the community. But there's nothing wrong with answering their questions.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And we're going to answer a couple of those questions later in today's show, talking about maybe, you know, values and religion, and does everything affect theology, et cetera. So we'll get to that a little bit. But on the way to Jumma, I had that realization that we just talked about, and I was like, I need to talk about this.
Yes.
And so I put together just like five things to think about based on the inauguration. And generally, they were all centered around this concept of, you know, just trusting that Allah has a plan.
Yeah.
Putting your, you know, rolling your sleeves up, you know, getting to work. And then at the end of it all, just realizing that, you know, Allah puts barakah when you work hard and sincerely at things. And, you know, one of the examples I gave was that, like, in Michigan, for example, during the primaries, the Michigan Muslims mobilized to vote for Bernie. Hafidhullah. And when they did, you know, you almost saw the numbers switching from Hillary to Bernie during that period. So Allah puts barakah in the work when we put our minds to it and really work hard.
Absolutely.
And put, you know, feet on the ground and kind of get going. So, a couple of people, it wasn't a, you know, good khutbah by any means. None of mine really are, but a couple of people afterwards were just really grateful that we even addressed the topic. Cause I think sometimes khutbahs can become kind of like a nap time for a lot of people.
Yes.
So that was my engagement with the inauguration besides,
And I think there's a balance here, by the way, because I do think that some people get distressed and worried. A lot of people are frustrated. Majority of the community is frustrated that, you know, on inauguration day, they'll show up for khutbah, and the khutbah will be about, you know,
the story of Prophet Yusuf.
Or just the virtues of making dua, which is a beautiful khutbah. But everybody just collectively was just traumatized.
Yeah, they witnessed like a very scary event.
A very traumatic event collectively as a community. And you can't just show up and just like give a random. But then there's another side. So I think the majority of the community is frustrated that the khutbah doesn't address what's going on. There are some people who are also more community leaders that also get distressed at the idea that the khutbah just can't be like TMZ. It can't be, you know, your Facebook timeline.
Yeah.
You know, there's a spiritual core to the khutbah. And what we've always talked about, like at Khatib Workshop and other places, is the balance in the middle is that you address what's going on right now, but you connect it to the text in a meaningful way where it's a hybrid of the two things.
Yeah. And there's and the beauty of the text is that it's so adaptable.
Yeah.
You should be able to find something.
Absolutely. I mean, I just talked about إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا صَالِحَاتٍ إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ لَفِي خُسْرٍ. When you're losing, إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا صَالِحَاتٍ. It's time to have faith and time to work.
That's amazing.
That's it.
Good summary.
That's it.
Aqim al-salah. Three seconds.
Aqim al-salah.
Best khutbah ever.
Best Jummah khutbah of all time.
One time I gave you Eid khutbah. And, you know, before Eid khutbah, I don't know if many of you know this, but Sheikh and I text each other that morning. Yeah. And we basically are like, all right, time your khutbah, because we have a competition who can keep it shorter. Because yeah. Eid is about Eid.
Party time.
Sounds a lot closer to eat than it does to listen. So we basically try to have a competition.
I mean, everybody realizes this, but particularly, let me tell you, when you do have kids, and when your kids are getting older, like my 9 and my 7-year-old, they cannot wait for, you know, party time and hang out with your friends and eat cupcakes and exchange gifts.
That's the whole point.
That's what they're looking forward to.
So Sheikh and I will and Mufti Hussein jumps into, and we always like have this like, you know, 8 minutes, 37 seconds. So one time an uncle came to me after my Eid khutbah and he was like, that was a great khutbah. Thank you so much. And I was kind of like, oh, interesting. I was like, yeah, you know, may Allah accept it. What did you like about it? What was your favorite part? And I was thinking more content. He goes, I don't know. I didn't listen, but it was so short. And I was like, hey man, I'll take a win wherever I can get one. Mashallah.
It is what it is.
So the inauguration khutbah, people appreciated it. And I think that as I got home, I kind of also started to fall into this like reflection. And this is a little sort of side point. I started watching Fox News almost exclusively because let me explain my logic here.
Yeah.
When we watch media that we generally
have to explain, it's fantastic entertainment.
First of all, it's great entertainment.
Yeah.
I believe I heard some pretty inappropriate jokes on the air. Wow. Like they're just a bunch of frat boys. It's crazy. It's nuts. Like I'm watching it and they're just like
sexist, racist.
Yeah, yeah. Just straight up. Just little like, you know, sort of like innuendo. And you're like, did he really just say that on the air? And I was like, anyways, it's shocking. But the reason why I watch it is because I noticed I was getting very frustrated. I was watching, you know, stuff on Twitter and Facebook. And the reason I was frustrated was because when you hear stuff that you agree with, your immediate question is, yes, why doesn't everyone agree with this?
Yeah.
So I'm like,
echo chamber.
Yes. And I'm like, I don't want to be in this echo chamber. I don't want to just be listening to things that I already agree with. Why don't I instead listen to things that I absolutely disagree with?
And then deconstruct their
ideas. So that way, number one, I can deconstruct. Number two, I can mock them while I'm watching it. So at least I'm getting some benefit because I'm a troll at heart. Yes. So I start watching Fox News and it is crazy. They're talking about Donald Trump like how we used to talk about Bernie. They're saying things like, oh, he's a fighter. He's anti-establishment. He beat all the odds. People were mocking him. And look who won now. And there, it's so interesting to me how they're speaking about him. And I think that's when the inauguration really set in, is that we're going to have to deal with this rhetoric for 4 years. Mm. And these kind of people. And they're literally saying things like, oh, crybabies, y'all lost, go home. The same people who are talking about the disunity of this country are like wagging their fingers in the faces of the liberal protesters. Instead of trying to rebuild, you know, they're trying to almost salt the wound.
Can we just say it?
What?
I know it's not going to sound very becoming. And
if you have children in the room, please.
Of me saying this and enjoying this, some are going to undoubtedly be disappointed, but one of the very serious contenders for the name of this podcast was the Nobody Cares podcast.
That's true.
That was a serious contender.
It was number two. Very
it
close.
It was number two. So
we were just afraid no one would listen if we said that.
Yeah. So even though I know some people are going to be disappointed with me saying this, but it is a Nobody Cares podcast, at least in my mind, in my heart. I enjoyed watching Richard Spencer get punched in the face.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Like, Islamically, like, is it wrong for me to be happy at that? Like, shouldn't a Muslim be
happy? I didn't do it.
Shouldn't a Muslim be happy when they see, like, bad things happen to bad people? Yeah.
Batil things happening to batil people.
Like, if Shaitan trips up the stairs, can I laugh? Like, is that okay?
Yeah. There's actually a narration, again, not to call a human being Shaitan, but there's a narration where the Prophet was kind of, like, sad and upset, and then he smiled, and they said, what happened? And he said, I saw Shaitan, like, lamenting, and he was putting dirt on his head, and it made me smile.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I love it. So there we go. There's your NUS. There's your source and Hadith, and we're good.
And
so,
just kept getting better because they were creating GIFs out of it.
The internet is incredible. I just hope that I'm always at the mercy of the internet. That if something ever happens to me on video, that the internet just decides to spare me. Because this place, they're ruthless, man. 14-year-old kids are ruthless. They go home to their suburban basements and
they go on their IMAX.
They go on their IMAX that mom and dad bought them. And right before Meatloaf is ready for dinner, they just put together these incredible pieces of art. Like there was the GIF where they put it to the like the beat of music.
It's so bad.
And they start cutting it. It was so good.
Anyways.
So Richard Spencer getting punched in the face, obviously. Big highlight. But going back to the inauguration, I think that's when it set in that this is the real deal. He started signing papers right away. I think he wanted to like freeze Obamacare right away.
Yeah.
There's all this stuff that he
raising
did.
The tax on like homeowners.
So what I know we had the whole like election podcast, we talked about how to deal with it, but now that this is like becoming real, right? Like what have your thoughts changed at all on how to approach this? Can you give us kind of like the Abdel-Nasser Jangda school of how to deal with President Trump?
Yeah, I think that the what I kind of said last Friday, I think kind of holds true. I think I had mentioned this before, but I think post-election, there was a lot of emphasis on just making sure, like taking spiritual care of ourselves, making sure we're okay, making sure that we're not demoralized, keep making your dua, don't lose your hope, don't lose your faith. But I think now that we're past the inauguration, I feel like it's time to put a much greater emphasis on getting out there and just doing work.
So basically, along with taking care of yourself, you got to also kind of like start taking care of everybody else.
Yeah, it's time to just like you've had 2 months to kind of lick your wounds and to kind of, you know, take some time off and get some bed rest, spiritual bed rest, and spiritually heal yourself. Now it's time to get out there and roll up your sleeve and do some work. Basically, the Bernie Sanders like school of just doing work.
It's just so amazing.
He hasn't gone home.
Hillary Clinton is like, Clinton's on a yacht somewhere.
Yeah, and does he even live anywhere anymore?
Hillary Clinton's on a yacht somewhere watching her husband look at other women. That video was so bad. Bill Clinton, dude.
So bad.
Freaking Bill, man.
So, you know, and
as long as the sun rises.
I have a friend who constantly kind of like, you know, gives this reminder about don't fetishize politicians and things like that. But I think it's very legitimate to say at this point that he's more activists and less politicians.
No, Bernie Sanders is just like he the reason it's not fetishization if a person is actually doing something.
Yeah.
I think that the fantasy of politicians is when they speak more and they don't do anything.
Yeah.
Bernie not only has he been doing something his entire life, but like he's doing more than us. Like he's like out there protesting, you know, tweeted about Linda Sarsour yesterday, who we'll get to. You know, just like speaking everywhere. There was a committee meeting where he was basically roasting one of Donald Trump's appointees. And he said, I'm sorry for being late. I was too busy roasting another appointee. So he basically sped up the roast for the first meeting. Then he went and quickly went to the next because he wanted to make sure that he could get in and throw a couple punches for both groups.
I've seen some video clips of him just tearing these nominees to
just no mercy. No mercy. Yeah. Like
his clip that really resonated with me was when he was interviewing, I think, Tom Price, the health and human services guy. And he was like, you know, we're a compassionate society. And
Tom Price said that, right?
Yeah. And he goes, no, sir, we are not a compassionate society.
Amazing.
We are not.
You know, we let people die.
We let people die. We let kids starve to death.
Yeah.
We let people with sicknesses die without health care. We are far from being a compassionate society.
There was an interesting article that I saw. I think my brother shared it today on Facebook, like 3 or 4 Harvard doctors who their primary field of study is mortality rates.
Wow.
So they basically came to a conclusion based off of initial research that the repealing of Obamacare in the way that it's being repealed, I think that there is a legitimate concern about how some aspects of it being someone who had to go through it. I definitely think there's some, but the repealing in the way that it's happening where it's more of a tribal symbol, a tribal sort of like they're dancing in the end zone right now.
Yeah,
it's
like
not
taking
actually
down somebody else's flag and putting on my flag.
It has nothing to do with actually helping us. Nothing. It's more about, okay, party lines. They said that I think like 45,000 plus people a year are just going to die simply from the way they're repealing it. Like it's not, they're not doing it with concern for humans. It's more about, again, party lines and symbols and stuff like that. Very strange. But Bernie's out there doing work.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of us can take heed in that. And again, what is work? Like, are you going to go to every protest? You can if you want. But I will always maintain that real work is done in neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And an example of that, you were the imam of Colleyville Masjid,
yeah.
You know, 5 years ago now, six yeah. years ago. I'm just sort of stepping into this role, following in your footsteps at this point. You know Rabbi Charlie.
Yeah.
And Rabbi Charlie is the local rabbi of the local synagogue in, I think it's called Colleyville Beth Israel.
Yeah.
And his wife, Adina.
Yes.
And they're both really big interfaith people.
Huge.
So they're always setting up things. Charlie and I did an event together. And what's interesting, I think a lot of Muslims aren't aware, is that the Jewish community is very much in a similar position as we are with this administration.
Well, yeah, the Bannon, the alt-right, the Breitbart people.
They're anti-Semitic. Super,
very.
This is a very interesting time for Muslims and Jewish communities in America to sort of unite and unify based on, you know, and we'll talk about what this means to ally, but to ally based on this collective sort of concern about...
With proper deference given to the issue of Palestine.
Absolutely. Yeah. No one's going to say that we're going to, you know, whitewash the
not
issue
gonna,
of...
We're not talking about going MLI.
No,
here.
In fact, Rabbi Charlie have had conversations. I just got what you said. I agree. Shout out to Jonathan Brown. But we just had a couple conversations about, you know, BDS and things like that. And, you know, I tried to explain to him that, you know, boycotting and sanctioning and divesting were always means of expressing discontent with the situation.
Correct.
And they're not violent, right? In fact, they are anti-violent, right?
Correct.
Like, they're actually trying to get people to
organized.
Not be violent. And they're organized. So we had some disagreements, but we both agree that this administration domestically shows a lot of fear. It's causing a lot of fear in our communities. So I went to this event that his wife organizes called Daughters of Abraham. Don't
yes.
ask why I was there. It's a long story, but I'm not a daughter of Abraham. But the whole concept is Jews, Muslims, and Christians.
Yeah, I remember.
And my wife went, alhamdulillah, and I went with her and Sister Asra and some other local aunties in the Colleyville area. And one of the questions that came up was about Sharia law. And this lady was asking me this question, and I had this moment where I just looked at her and she's like, what about Sharia law? And she had so much fear in her voice. She was so scared. And so I kind of like just answered her question, talked about how Sharia is the personal faith code of every Muslim. It has things to do with, and I talked about the difference between how the majority of law and actually the only law that is going to be truly applicable to a Muslim in America is the personal law. Mm. The state law is only for countries that do follow organized state religious politics. I was like, America's not that. So we follow individual religious laws, you know, as long as our state laws don't violate, which none of them in America technically do. So I sort of gave her a clarification on Sharia law. And then it hit me at the end of the answer. I said, this is literally a person who voted for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is the work that we need to be doing. We need to be going out there, meeting these people. And not all of them are insufferable Steve Bannons. Not all of them are Richard Spencers, right, where they need to get their Johnnies to meet my fist, right? Some of them are just, you know, Julie, who lives down the street, who's just concerned, dude. Mm-hmm. She just heard a bunch of crazy stories about ISIS, and she just wants to make sure that you're normal.
Yeah,
and by normal, like, meaning like a nice person.
Yeah.
So do work, man. Meet people. Go do things. And don't ever underestimate the power of bringing food.
Yeah.
You know, taking Krispy Kremes to work, bringing, you know, brownies, samosas to your class. That kind of stuff goes a long way. It opens up doors.
And one of the things I was telling... who was I telling this to? I was talking about this with... Yes, I had to give the MSA talk yesterday evening at UTA. And I mentioned this to them, that your heart, like the faith, the heart that holds your faith and your iman, it's a muscle and it has to be exercised.
Mm-hmm.
To find our own capacity for goodness and to be able to navigate these treacherous waters, you have to also exercise your heart. Like when we were driving right now and we saw a bunch of people sleeping under a bridge, like taking out an extra 30 minutes and like grabbing a bunch of food and going there and just dropping some food off to them. See, that's you exercising your iman, exercising your heart, so that when the moment comes for action, you will have the capacity to take that action.
Absolutely. It's like people who practice so that they're ready for the game.
Yes. So you're not paralyzed in that moment.
Yeah. Like, like either mentally, spiritually, or literally physically, because your heart, your body follows your heart.
Yeah, exactly.
So your body won't go buy food for someone if your heart hasn't empathized with them.
So when that moment comes that we got to actually march in the street and stand up for people's rights.
Absolutely.
We're all going to be like scared and paralyzed within our homes. But if we're exercising our iman in our heart on a daily basis with our salah, with our dua, with our Quran, but also with feeding somebody hungry down the street and with showing somebody kindness in our neighborhoods, that's going to exercise our capacity to do good.
And I actually want to, I'm so glad you brought this up, man, because I think that in the Muslim community, especially in America, we have conflated the word success with like material success.
Yeah.
And we oftentimes forget that the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam's first and strongest followers, even till Medina, I mean, look at Abu Huraira,
right.
The majority of them were really, really struggling. They were financially, I mean, look at Ahl al-Suffa,
right.
Look at the individuals who, Ali ibn Abi Talib,
right.
You know, his father Abu Talib couldn't take care of him. That's why the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam came in and swooped in and helped.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from day one, the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, one of the reasons Khadija said that you'll never be in God's punishment is because you always take care of people, you know? So the concept of don't ever think that taking care of those who are really financially in need is like extracurricular. It's actually very much at the foundation of what it means to be close to Allah.
Absolutely.
And the other thing is that this is one thing that one of our mutual friends, Nadeem Siddiqui in Knoxville, told me, and it really resonated with me. He said that the community that forgets the poor will always be struggling, meaning that the ones who leave the poor, they leave, or not just the poor, but the marginalized by society, that community will never succeed. They'll always fail because they become obsessed with just being, living in big houses, getting new cars, all that kind of stuff, which is all permissible according to Islam, but there are conditions.
Of course.
And if I'm going to be honest, I don't know if I or any of the community really is fulfilling the conditions of taking care of those in need enough to be enjoying the luxuries that we have.
Right.
So that's a big deal. And that's a big checklist to add to this. And I think, honestly, you see what happens when people start to protect the rights of others. The next day after the inauguration, what happens? You have the largest march in the history of this country.
Unbelievable.
And really what it is people got together and they decided to take a stand. I know there's a lot of, you know, discussion about the legitimacy and some of the concerns, especially about white privilege and especially about how some concerns were propped up while others weren't. But it's really important for Muslims to be people of partial credit and not binary all or nothing.
Right.
We should be happy that people were even able to organize and voice their concerns. And I did hear some rhetoric about, well, they didn't include the issue of Palestine or they didn't include this issue, so they shouldn't be doing anything at all. Well, I'm happy faith isn't that way.
Yeah.
Because God knows I'm not doing literally every single thing.
No, and there's a principle we have in our usul that basically says, if you can't do all of something, you should not abandon a part of something.
Yeah, like if a person misses Fajr, they're like, oh, I got a free day today.
Yeah.
No,
you still pray your Dhuhr.
You still pray your Dhuhr and your Asr. And in fact, you should make up your Fajr.
Yeah, if somebody didn't fast the first week of Ramadan just due to heedlessness, just not caring, and then all of a sudden they snap awake, they should start fasting that second week of Ramadan.
So this is an important principle. Sorry to hit the mic there. This is an important principle, especially with regards to activism, which is no one's really going to be the perfect activist, are they?
No.
Like, are you going to have one person that's going to truly? And this is, by the way, the woke Olympics. You see it a lot on the internet. This
the woke of, Olympics.
Where it's like, who can be the most woke? And then like the minute you miss a step.
I think that baby was the most woke.
The Asian baby?
So woke.
What, I love naps, but I'm woke.
And then there was another baby who was just holding up a sign with a bunch of like scribbles all over it. Like crayon scribbles.
That's awesome. It's so good.
But get over it.
The woke Olympics on the internet, on Twitter, like you see this actually. And I was actually talking to one of our mutual friends, Ali Baluch, aka Abu 7-Eleven Hot Dog. And he and I were talking in Spain, and he was talking about how the internet's ruthless.
Yeah.
If you wake up and you missed like something that went on and you didn't add it to your Twitter profile that, oh, I'm anti this or I'm pro this. Then all of a sudden you're as good as garbage.
Yeah, you're
discarded. That's not an Islamic concept, dude.
Yeah.
That's just not how we work. I mean, the Prophet accepted and took people partial credit, right?
Yes.
So can we talk a little bit about the Women's March? What were your thoughts? What did you think about it?
I just thought it was amazing. I was really happy. I was very happy for the folks who participated. I was happy for the folks who supported. I was happy for just this country that people were able to get together and express themselves, and particularly not just a group of people, not a minority, the majority, which are women in this country, and in the world for that matter. But I was just happy that people were able to, who felt disrespected, were able to get together and basically assert themselves and just say that we're not going to tolerate your disrespect.
And I thought that it was something, it was a bright spot in a very dark time.
Yeah. And I understand what critiques and criticisms are there, but again, it's that if you can't do all of something good, you don't stop doing a part of something good.
Yeah.
And there was definitely good that was done, and I'm okay with that.
So another question. I know that you had class that morning, so it was not, you know, you had work. Would you have gone yourself?
Yeah.
Had you been free? Would you have taken your kids?
Yeah.
Okay. So how do we, because now we're going into the Muslim internet, Muslim territory.
Nice.
Where, you know, Linda Sarsour, for example, Correct. Great sister, mashallah. She was one of the co-organizers.
Yes,
she was like at the top of this, and you know,
all the way in DC.
She's someone that's been doing work. You know, the iceberg kind of thing. She's been doing work for 80% of her work life has been behind the scenes in the shadows.
I mean, literally decades.
Yeah. Doing amazing work organizing. And
for like
now,
20 years, but over the last 2 years, there's been some notoriety.
Yeah. And now she's kind of getting the notoriety and respect, partially that, you know, partially part of that she deserves, meaning that she still isn't getting full respect. Mm-hmm. She should. But you know, alhamdulillah, people are starting to recognize the work that she does. And with that recognition came a lot of cynicism, you know, from the Muslim community, because that's what we do.
Yes.
We try to add a little bit of lemon to people's lemonade, make a little bit more bitter instead of adding some sugar. But some of the concerns, I can see where they're coming from.
Sure.
But knowing you and having studied with you for, you know, a few years now, I think my mind is just so attuned to being able to see maybe not exactly what you'll say, but kind of how you'll approach things. And I still call you and check with you, but I think that I'm getting to that point now where I can see that, well, this is kind of what Sheikh would say, or this is what he has said about certain things. People were talking about, for example, allying with the homosexual movement.
Sure.
Or modern day feminism, which has so many different iterations, right? It's not just like a monolith.
No.
You know, not every feminist is like saying the things that maybe Islam doesn't completely agree with.
Right.
And not every feminist, and there's a lot of also disagreement within feminism, you know, even like European feminism.
Like I know a lot of activists and academics and people that I respect their opinion a lot. Women in this country who are basically fighting the cause for, you know, different issues in women's rights, that there are some celebrity feminist types, whether it be the lady from Hunger Games,
Jennifer Lawrence,
or it be that lady, Lena Dunham.
Oh, yeah. She's wild. She's crazy.
And I know that they're very, very critical and just kind of, they say that they don't represent what we're actually, the work we're trying to do.
Yeah.
And then you have folks like, what's the sister's name? Nina, who was the Bernie Sanders supporter. Really remarkable African-American woman, black woman, but Nina something. And so, you know, and she would maybe basically disagree with a lot of other feminists or a lot of the other work or movements that are going on, saying that it's very, very whitewashed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically white feminism
that's
being represented or portrayed. So, yeah, there's always going to be these different, I guess you can say, schools of thought.
Yeah. And there's a lot of sort of, and I think that goes to say that there's nuance in everything.
Yes.
You see it in faith. You see it in ideology. You see it in politics. You see it in social activism. And the minute you are going to be like, well, it should be one way or no way, that's just not reality of life.
For some of our more nerdy kind of listeners, you have Egyptian Hanafis, Syrian Hanafis, Turkish Hanafis, and Indian Hanafis. And all four of them could not be more different than each other.
And Egyptian Hanafis are the best. Imam Tahawi. Shout out to Imam Tahawi.
Imam Tahawi is the man.
He is the man. So tying back into that, I had someone approach me last night. I had a few people message me. I think you also had a couple on Snapchat message you about the permissibility or the, even if you don't want to get too legal, the impact of allying with a movement or a protest or attending a protest. Because you just said you would have gone.
Right.
And you know, you knew that going, there were people there who maybe supported things that your faith has critical opinions about.
Correct.
Your faith teaches you, for example, that marriage is between
a man and a woman.
Man and a woman. Okay. And the institution is sacred. The institution, yes, of marriage is not flexible. It's not something where we can say, oh, we can adjust. We're not, there's no reformed marriage institution. It, right, is what it is. This is the way that Allah, you know, defined it for us, and the Prophet ﷺ exemplified for us.
That's right.
Yet we know that we could be marching next to somebody who believes that it is perfectly okay. And in fact, it is good. It's progressive. It's something that's healthy for society, for two men or two women to get married.
Right.
The first question I have for you is, how do you internally negotiate that? Mm. Do you think that situation that I just described is something worth just completely avoiding these kind of environments for? And the second question I'll ask you is, from a Muslim perspective, what is important for us to know about ourselves and others that we may disagree with, for us to be able to see them as human beings?
Yeah.
Because I think that really is what the core of the issue is.
Correct.
Is the humanization or lack thereof of people that we disagree with. So the first question is, how do you negotiate that situation?
So I think there's a spiritual issue here and then a more academic issue, if you will. Technical issue. The spiritual issue is simply this, that if somebody feels that you and I,
mm-hmm,
addressing a real concern that we both agree upon. So let's just say that there's an activist in my community who agrees that the public school system, the public education system, needs some very serious reform.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree in regards to that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now that activist who I'm talking about in my community is either somebody who is gay or somebody who also equally participates in activism for gay rights.
Or we can widen this example, the legalization of marijuana.
Yeah.
Which in, you know, Muslim legal circles, we understand marijuana to be the default is impermissible. Obviously there's medical, right, exceptions,
sure,
but the default is that marijuana is impermissible. We maybe, right, have an episode about that later.
Sure.
So someone who's a big time advocate for the use of recreational marijuana.
Right.
So how do we align?
So what happens is that, okay, he's got those causes as well, but we agree in regards to this cause about public educational reform, mm-hmm, or about criminal justice reform, or we're both protesting, you know, the
wage inequality,
the, mm-hmm, killing of black people by police officers. So there's causes that we agree in regards to. Now, each situation, right? This is an issue of fiqh. Each mas'ala, yes, they all tie together. There is usul that tie everything together. But each case, each mas'ala, each situation is assessed individually.
Mas'ala, by the way, for those, is like a scenario.
That's right.
And usul means principles.
Principles, yeah.
So there's like guiding principles
that, yeah, tie everything together, but each scenario is assessed and analyzed and thereby addressed individually.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the only, like a doctor or physician isn't going to, if you go in to see him and you kind of say, my stomach's hurting, he's not going to say, oh, I had somebody else come in this morning whose stomach was hurting as well, and this is what I gave him, so just take this and go.
Yeah, it's kind of like how you use fire to cook everything, but they're, yeah, different ingredients.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And even the size or the temperature of the fire would be different.
Absolutely.
Right? So therefore, you handle each case individually. So in this case, in this instance, that person, okay, whoever that person may be, that person is right now an advocate of public education reform. I'm an advocate of public education reform. And therefore, we're working on this one issue together. Tomorrow, that person is going to be, you know, protesting for the legalization of gay marriage. If I don't agree with that, then I'm just not going to participate there. The day after, he's going to be participating in a protest for the legalization of recreational marijuana. I don't agree with that. So I'm just not going to go and participate. And there's just that maturity that's going to be there. Now, I said right now, it's the spiritual issue. This is where the spiritual issue is. The spiritual issue right now occurs where people say, well, if you go and you protest public education reform with him or criminal justice reform with him, then somebody who knows that he also is an advocate of gay marriage or legalization of recreational marijuana, that they're going to get confused about Islam allows that, and it's going to cause them a crisis of faith.
It's like, quote unquote, like approval by association.
Yeah. That points to a few things. That tells you that there's a weakness, there's a deficiency in knowledge of what our religion is, aqidah. There's a deficiency and a lack of identity, spirituality, and confidence within one's religion. So there's a lack of knowledge, a lack of identity, and a lack of spirituality. Now, the real remedy to this situation is educate, teach, build the spirituality. Educate them about what their religion is. Teach them what their identity is, who they are, the seerah. And then, so this, the Quran is a seerah. And number three is build their spirituality through community and fellowship. So you need to teach them Quran, you need to teach them seerah, and you need to involve them into a fellowship, a community. That's a solution to that problem. And then people will have the ability and the nuance to be able to say, hey, Brian, or hey, Jason, or hey, Jessica, or whoever you are, we're going to get together and address the prison system. We're going to get together and address the school system. But understand that I'm not going to be able to participate in those other protests with you because of my faith-related issues, and I'm completely okay with that, and it's not causing me a crisis of faith.
I think that having that nuance is actually very much appreciated. Mm-hmm. I was doing this panel in the University of Tennessee when I was the chaplain there, and the Muslim chaplain there, and it was on sexuality and religion. And one of the questions I was asked was, you know, how would you handle this scenario? And basically it was two people of the same gender, either men or women, would walk in and ask for you to conduct their... So they're part of your congregation, mm-hmm. And they would ask for you to conduct their marriage.
Sure.
And so basically my answer was, some of the more orthodox people on the panel said absolutely not, and they were like kind of more hardline. Some of the more reformed people said, yeah, we have no issue with that kind of thing. And what you noticed was the orthodox people were very much falling into the pit hole of dehumanizing the people. Mm-hmm. So they would talk about the sin more than they talked about the individuals.
Yeah.
And then the reformed would talk about the individual and then completely ignore the fact that they believe that it, or they, that some people view this as immoral. Mm-hmm. Right. So there was like this extremes. And the way I answered it was, I said that I would, if two people, two men or two women walked and asked me to conduct their marriage, I would, first I would welcome them. I'd ask them, you know, what are you guys drinking? We got lemonade, we got water, we got tea, we got coffee. I would maybe call, you know, someone, an assistant at the masjid, and place an order for food and have, you know, some food brought in, feed them lunch, ask them how they're going. What are you guys reading? Have you watched any movies? Like, really just get to know them. And then as the conversation sort of turned towards, you know, conducting their marriage, I would just very politely, let them know that, you know, I know we just had this time together and I got to know you guys better. But it is my belief, and it is the belief of this institution, that marriage is exclusively between men and women. Mm-hmm. And as such, I will not be able to religiously conduct your marriage. However, I'm still your brother. I'm still, you know, at your service as your imam. If you ever need anything from me, I will do whatever the religion allows me to do for mm-hmm. you. And that answer actually got a standing ovation. And the crowd was mostly from the LGBT community. And there was actually one guy in the audience whose mother converted to Islam. And ever since she converted, her husband told her that she cannot talk to her son anymore because her son's gay. Cannot talk. And this is literally dehumanization. So because your son is gay, he's no longer your son, which is going to lend itself to a point I'm going to make in a second. He came to me with tears in his eyes and he said, I've never been comfortable with my mom's conversion until today. When you basically articulated that, she's still my mom. She just doesn't necessarily agree with what I'm doing in this way or how I feel I have to live my life. This is who I am.
Right.
And we can disagree on that, just like a person might disagree, for example, about a certain taste in something else mm-hmm. or a certain reality of something else. Mm-hmm. And he actually said that he was most comfortable with the answer that I'd given. Again, this is just from stuff that I learned from talking with you and you know, Omar Muzaffar and other people that we all have mutual friends about. But I think one of the things that we struggle with, Sheikh, is that we have a very strong threat of homophobia in our community, mm-hmm. not in our religion, but our community, meaning that even Christian Arabs are homophobic, mm-hmm. right? Even Hindus are very, very uncomfortable with homosexuality. Like a Hindu kid going to his mom and saying, I'm gay, I don't know how they would take that, right?
Not very well.
The Eastern world is very traditional in a lot of ways. And so there is a lot of what we would call in America homophobia. And that lends itself to now this whole like taking away of someone's humanity.
Mm-hmm.
What you've described in your answer is still giving that person their humanity while disagreeing with them, which I think is a sign of an intelligent human being,
right.
That you're able to disagree with parts of people's life, their choices, how they view their life as being without throwing them completely away.
When somebody just kind of says that, oh, it's going to jeopardize or it's going to confuse people or, you know, it's going to jeopardize people's faith. And I'm like, then what kind of faith that you have that the wind can just come and just blow it all down?
Yeah. You know, Imam Ghazali talks about this in his Rites of Companionship. He says that if being around people impacts your faith so much, he said, there's something wrong with you then.
Yeah.
He actually said that because he said that you can't excommunicate somebody. It's not allowed in our religion.
The faith, the analogy. The faith the scholars describe is supposed to be the ark of Nuh alayhi salam, of Noah, you know, amidst the flood.
Mm.
Your faith is supposed to help you withstand the greatest natural disaster punishment from God that this world's ever witnessed.
So let me ask you then, I don't know if I want to go to this one. Let me go here first. Okay. We were talking earlier about, is there any precedent in the life of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wasallam where allying with people that we have different values.
That's the second thing I was going to say. Yeah. There's a technical answer. So that's just a spirituality concern. I think there's just a weakness of knowledge and spirituality, which makes us like so afraid of our own shadow.
Yeah.
That all of a sudden the whole community is just going to apostatize. You know, Sister Linda's being attacked by Islamophobes. And if we come out and we support Sister Linda and be like, don't attack our sister, the fact that Sister Linda has advocated and fought for LGBT rights as well, that because I'm going to stand up for my sister who has stood up, you know, and fought, you know, for the rights of a community that I might not completely agree with their practices in regards to, that somehow all of our teenagers are just going to apostatize overnight. Like, it's just so bizarre.
Yeah.
And if that will actually happen, the problem wasn't the fact that we supported Sister Linda. The problem is the fact that maybe we haven't been doing the work in our communities that we should have been.
And what about like every other sin that exists?
Yeah.
Like, are we afraid that like when we drive by an establishment that serves alcohol, that like the entire community is going to run in there and take body shots? Like, that's it's so interesting. That's why I brought up the homophobic point, because I think that there's a nerve here that's being hit. And when we compare it objectively to other things, other sins in our religion, like drinking, like smoking, like stealing,
mm-hmm.
like it's so interesting. Not only are we so much advocating and dehumanizing gay people, but at the same time, like, we as a community own a lot of the establishments, especially in black neighborhoods, that sell liquor
mm-hmm.
and that sell tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see very much community advocacy about that. I don't see very many Facebook posts talking about
we should stop boycotting. Like, we should not fly anymore, because whenever you fly, they're serving alcohol on the plane.
Exactly. Oh, and
so if I take my kids on a plane and somebody's sitting in the seat next to them drinking, you know, some alcohol, some wine, then it's going to confuse my kid about this must be permissible because my dad's sitting right next to the guy and is not saying anything about it.
Yeah. I mean, forget even people who are like, oh, it's on the plane. I mean, you go to countries that are majority Muslim.
Yeah.
In Turkey, we went to Shake Shack on Kadam Turkey, and we had to walk through what it seemed like it was like crossing the Sirat of bars, dude. Like, we were like walking on this path, and it was just like nightclub after nightclub.
I landed at the Abu Dhabi airport, and as soon as you came into, like,
you mean the Abu Dhabi winery?
Yeah. As soon as you come into the whole, like, the transit lounge where all the shops and everything, like, I don't know why, but the world's biggest mall is inside the airport.
Well, and it's actually a mall that they just have airplanes land at.
Yeah. So the first store we're greeted by is just the biggest liquor shop I've ever seen in my entire life.
And you live in Texas.
I do. And Abdullah, my brother, was with me, and he started laughing because it said that if you buy this much liquor, they would give you a free suitcase so that you can pack your liquor in the suitcase.
That's so ridiculous. I remember when my wife and I landed in Amman in Jordan.
Yeah.
And we were on our way for Umrah. There was a Ramadan special on alcohol.
That's just so bad.
It's wild. And again, I'm not criminalizing the entire country, but what I'm saying is we have very intense double standards when it comes to sins. Imam Suhaib said one time, it was really powerful. He said, don't dehumanize or hate somebody just because they sin differently than you.
Yeah.
And we all got something we're working on. So the homosexuality bit, I think we've covered it, but the technical side, which is...
Technical side I was going to say was...
Is there precedence in the life of the Messenger?
So I... somebody asked me this question. I was telling them that... Okay, so this is going to get a little technical, but I'm going to try to talk it out and keep it as simple in English as possible. The Treaty of Hudaybiyah, which basically was in the sixth year of the Prophet's residence in the city of Medina, the sixth year of Hijrah. So that is 6 plus 13, about 19 years after he received the message, 19 years into prophethood. They were going for Umrah. The Prophet and the Muslims were going for Umrah to go do the minor pilgrimage in Mecca. The Meccans came out of Mecca and basically said, because they were still involved in a battle, a war with each other. They had had multiple battles, so they were still seen as enemies. They came out and they said no, and eventually they had some negotiations and a treaty was signed. It was called the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. It happened at the place of Hudaybiyah. So part of the treaty was that Muslims will not attack, Medina will not attack Mecca, Mecca will not attack Medina for 10 years. They will not attack each other. Okay, truce. What else was included, the second term of the treaty was, the Muslims had an ally by the name of Khuza'a. It was a tribe by the name of Khuza'a. They were the allies of the Muslims. And the Meccans, the Quraysh, they had allies, a tribe by the name of Banu Bakr. They were the allies of the Meccans, of the Quraysh. They were also included within the treaty. What that means is Muslims will not attack Mecca. Mecca will not attack the Muslims. The Quraysh will not attack the Muslims. But the Meccans will also not attack the allies of the Muslims, Khuza'a, nor vice versa. And the Muslims will not also not attack the allies of the Meccans, Banu Bakr, and vice versa.
So basically two opposing sides are saying you can't attack us or our friends.
Or our friends. And the friends will not attack each other as well.
So our friends are going to stay cool as well.
Exactly. Okay. So Khuza'a will not attack Banu Bakr either. So that was the second term of the treaty. For 10 years, this was part of the treaty. And Khuza'a was not Muslim. They were mushrik. They were idol worshippers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they were idol, pagan, idol-worshipping, stone and wood-worshipping Arab Bedouins.
And let's pause here and think for a moment. Like every verse in the Quran that talks about the worshipping of idols, talks about the oneness of God.
Mm-hmm.
This is literally the oneness of God and worshiping God alone.
It's the deal breaker.
Well, it's like the primary function of prophets.
Yeah.
Their function is to come and teach
us.
Literally, like Allah is saying that we only sent the prophets, except that they would come down and basically say that there is nothing worthy of worship except for Allah. And so if we're thinking about on the scale of everything that's
happening.
إِنَّ
اللَّهَ لَا يَغْفِرُ أَنْ يُشْرَكَ بِهِ وَيَغْفِرُ مَا دُونَ ذَلِكَ لِمَنْ يَشَاءُ. God won't forgive idol worship, like idolatry, polytheism, worshiping something other than God, but he'll forgive everything else.
It's just so mind-blowing to me. And this is why I think this has become like a big construct, is that we've made sins theological in nature, meaning like we've made them akida, and we've made akida like almost legal. It's very strange. We flipped them.
I was having a conversation with another group of scholars, and one scholar particularly made this point that we're more sensitive to political issues or political disagreements. We draw more deeper lines along political issues today than we do even along theological lines.
Yeah. And that's not to say that if someone does worship other than Allah, we should also throw
like
them out.
Yeah, like we want to murder them.
Like I just talked about Rabbi Charlie, but what I'm saying is look at how we respond to people with their different lifestyle, maybe sinful lifestyles, versus how friendly we are with people. So continue the story then.
Yeah, so what happened was Banu Bakr and Quraysh attacked the allies of the Muslims, Khuza'a.
They violated the treaty.
Khuza'a, they massacred them, actually. And Khuza'a, some of their people who escaped, they came to Medina covered in blood. And they came to the Prophet ﷺ and they said, look what happened to us. You gave us your word. And the Prophet ﷺ at that time was not interested in a fight with the Meccans. He said he wanted to enjoy this time of peace. But he said, I must keep my word and defend their rights. And he launched an attack against Mecca, which became the conquest of Mecca, to protect the rights, the humanity and the rights of Khuza'a, who are idol worshippers.
And this is, again, if you can just appreciate that this time period in the life of the Prophet ﷺ was like the first time where they could live without threat from Quraysh.
Correct.
So going like this attack, it would have been very comfortable and convenient for the Prophet ﷺ to say, like, look, man, I'm sorry it happened to you.
Right. And Abu Sufyan came to Medina when the leaders
tried to negotiate
the treaty, kind of be like, hey, why don't we just establish our peace again? I know that thing happened with Khuza'a. It was kind of nasty, but why don't we're cool with each other, right? We're cool with each other. And the Prophet could have said that, yeah, totally. We're totally cool with each other.
He could have been like, yeah, you know what? We had that, but each man for themselves kind of thing, but didn't. And again, allying and protecting the agreement, you know, you can go, I mean, there's Constitution of Medina protecting everyone who lives here. There's the Jewish farmers who were attacked, and there's, you know, all these different examples, and the Prophet still stood up for them, even though they disagreed with his function. Mm-hmm. Like his, you know, we're talking about one of the questions people ask is, how can you disagree with what makes a person who they are, especially with homosexuality? Like, that makes them who they are. Sexuality is so important for a human being. Well, this is what made the Prophet who he was. Mm-hmm. This message is who he is. This is his whole purpose in life, is to come. And these are people who are telling him, we think you are lying.
Yes.
And he is saying, I will protect you.
Yes.
So they're basically saying, we disagree with you, your very essence. We disagree with you, and he's still protecting them.
Yes.
Which shows you, like, that is what...
Yeah, he's not endorsing their shirk. He's not making it the policy.
Not compromising.
He's not compromising at all, but he's basically saying, you have a right to have dignity and protection of your life and property and your families, and you deserve to not be massacred and violated within your homes.
Which sounds like human rights.
Yes.
And for those of you who maybe are listening, who maybe have extra time and want to go a little bit deeper, if you go to episode 139 of the Sierra podcast, that covers the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. It was recorded on June 2nd of 2016. So just pop on over there and you can listen to that, inshallah. If you want to get like the full story, I believe it's actually even in two parts.
Yeah.
And then recently you guys covered in January the breaking of the treaty, which is what we just talked about. This summary was really good.
That's actually what we're going
on. But whoever is, you know, putting on their nerd caps a little bit wants to learn a bit more, it's for everybody. But you can go over and listen. So that's a really, really strong argument, because to conclude the argument, shirk and kufr, which is worshiping other than Allah, denying Allah, much worse than sins, yeah?
Yes.
Okay, so homosexuality, as much as Islam is that critical of it.
We were reflecting over one time in Surah Maryam. Takadu samawatu
That's serious. Like, the earth and the sky want to tear themselves apart whenever anyone
and
says.
Devour the human being.
Whenever anyone says that God has a son. Meaning that this notion or this belief of attributing such a human characteristic to God, which what it leads to, which
so
is what we see,
is
so offensive to
Allah.
Creation. The other, you know, parts of creation, earth and sky, they want to kind of just destroy themselves. They just want to die, basically. Yeah. You know, when you hear something, you're just like, I'm dead. I just want to die. That's what the earth and the sky feel. But Allah didn't give a similar... You know, Allah did not give a similar description to when people exist who are homosexual. Granted, we understand Qawmi Lut, we understand, but is it, can we also clarify something about Qawmi Lut? This is always a question that I get, and I always have to clarify to people, and they tend to also be surprised when I say this, that people were not destroyed only because of their sin, but because of the kufr that their sin led to.
No. It's clearly documented. Like, the people of Madian who were unethical in their business dealings were also mushrik.
Yes. And the people of Qawmi Lut who
were also mushrik.
Yeah. And also, sin has a habit of reinforcing this.
Yes.
Sin has a habit of, because what sin does is it poisons the heart, and the poisoned heart cannot reflect upon Allah.
Exactly.
It covers it in this rust, and then the person is unable to appreciate Allah Ta'ala. And so that's why Allah Ta'ala says, you know, يُدُلُّهُ بِكَثِيرًا وَيَهْدِي بِكَثِيرًا. Like, the same Quran guides people and misguides people. Why? Because the hearts are different.
Yeah.
The ones who are guided, their hearts are clean. The ones who are misguided, their hearts are poisoned. So the sin of homosexuality and engaging in that act of Lut that is what reinforced this shirk and this kufr, and that's why God destroyed these people.
Right.
Otherwise, God would just destroy everybody because we're all sinning all the time. Right? So sin alone is not enough for God to destroy people. He's not.
The Prophet ﷺ says in a hadith that man fatatuhu salatun fakannama wutira maluhu wa ahluhu, that somebody who misses a prayer, it's like they all their family. That means like Maryam, Aisha, Muhammad. And
for me, it means Maureen and Sherlock. And inshallah soon, baby, inshallah.
Inshallah. That their family and all their property, all their wealth was all destroyed, annihilated.
Subhanallah.
Wiped out.
Subhanallah. But still, you don't see Allah flipping over nations.
No.
And again, we don't ever question or understand completely the wisdom of Allah Ta'ala, but this is used as a proof as to why these people are just, you know, oh, well, if God flipped over, if he destroyed Qawmi Lut, and then they're just the scum of the earth and we should never come. Dude, there was much more to that. Mm-hmm. These people were unethical, immoral people. It wasn't just that they had problems with their sexual orientation,
right,
but it was more of, and not just problems, right? But sexual orientation, it might be that someone has it, but the action of it is what the issue was.
The action.
Okay. And the other thing is that they were also just bad people.
Right.
I mean, they were also just really bad people. And so there's this concept of that doesn't mean that homosexuality is okay.
Not at all.
As an action. But what it means is that it was a compound issue. It wasn't just a singular issue. Hence why it's not okay for someone to take that story and make a vast legal ruling on not standing next to or working with someone who perhaps is gay or lesbian or bisexual. But at the same time, holding the identity that I don't think that's what God wants.
Right, exactly.
I think that, again, like I said, that nuance is so important.
Very comfortably and confidently saying that same-sex marriage is not permissible in Islam. Homosexual, like the lifestyle, like the activity itself, that sexual activity is haram and impermissible in Islam. Very comfortably, very confidently being able to say that. But at the same time, equally comfortably and confidently being able to say that when a human being is disrespected or violated or persecuted, I will not tolerate that.
Yeah.
That's it.
Because everyone has rights despite whatever disagreements we have. Can I ask you a question, though, that's bound to come up in people's minds? So Islam has a variety of protocol. Mm-hmm. God gives us a variety of things to do, things not to do. A lot of those things make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. You know, not drinking makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes you lose your senses. Not smoking makes a lot of sense, connected to almost like every cancer, does the horrible things to your body. What is so wrong about two people who love each other, maybe being from the same gender? What is obviously we'll never know the clear and all reason as to why Allah did that, because that would assume that we are as smart as God.
Right.
But what are some of the wisdoms behind that? Like for everyone here, because I don't want everyone to feel like we're walking away from this just being like, it's wrong and that's it. What are some like practical understanding reasons? I have a couple in mind, but I wanted to kind of get your, if someone came up to you at an MSA and asked that question, like, what's the big deal? Why can't we just be okay with it?
So technically speaking, we have different components of you know, legality in Islam. So there's a hukum, which is a ruling. Now for a ruling, there is many, there are multifold what we call hikam, wisdoms, hikmah.
Mm.
There are many wisdoms and benefits to a ruling. Then there is an illah, there is an underlying reason and cause of that ruling. Now, the illah sometimes is mansus alayha, which means it is stated in the text, this is why you do this or this is why you don't do this. And sometimes that illah is ghayr mansus alayha, it is not clearly laid out, stated and stipulated, this is why you do this or this is why you don't do this.
Mm-hmm.
When it is laid out, we know it. When it's not laid out, we try to figure it out, but we can never ultimately 110% know whether or not that is the actual underlying reason or not. When it comes to this particular ruling about the impermissibility of same-sex, you know, sexual activity, let alone marriage, the underlying reason is not absolutely explicitly stated within the text.
Mm-hmm.
So now we can try to figure it out. Sometimes we'll be on the mark, sometimes we'll be off the mark, sometimes it might be critiqued afterwards. And so what we do know is that we will be able to ascertain many benefits of it, such as, you know, understanding the vast overwhelming majority of human history, looking at the biology of people, looking at procreation and reproduction, that those are all going to be benefits. As far as seeing it as the absolute underlying reason, then we won't be able to say that with certainty.
I think that...
Even within that is humility is just part of the test of faith and belief
So
just doing what you're told.
That's what I was going to come to is that, you know, I always approach things like you're obviously like hadith oriented fiqh, like superstars. That's like your, that's where you love. Understand. No, you are. Come on. It's all right. Put on the hat a little bit.
Trying to figure out what I'm going to have for lunch.
So, but for me, like I study fiqh with you, but I obviously have always, because of the psychology background, I've always been much more like kind of, time flies when I'm reading like things on like tazkiyah and like, mm-hmm. just like iman and like those kind of things, fawaid, I guess. Mm-hmm. So for me, what I always think about whenever anyone asks is, well, we can talk about the legality of it, but the majority of people that I talk to, the legality isn't like the big convincing thing. What it is for them is exactly the last point, which you said, which is that, if someone trusts somebody and loves somebody, then they're not going to pry and peel at every single thing that they're doing. If I come to your house and you say, hey man, you want some chai? And I say, yeah, sure. I'm not going to go and look over your shoulder and tell you what to do. Mm. I'm just going to sit down and relax and trust that you're going to make a good cup of tea. So if Allah and his messenger, Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, tell me to do something, my love and trust of them, Allah and his messenger, is going to be... It should, and hopefully that's the struggle of the heart. It should be enough for me to say, I'm good. Like, that's good enough for me. Mm. And it's that trust component. So, again, why is it such a big deal? I may not know all the right reasons. I could give you a bunch of conversational points about the institution of family and the moral ontology. Like, where do we draw the line? If we open it up here, like, where does the line get drawn? If the definition of marriage equality is two consenting adults who love one another, then why do some states ban cousin marriage? What about sibling marriage? Well, okay, well, then there's issues, health issues. Well, what if sex is not the goal? What if it's just companionship? Yeah. And two siblings want to get married. They just want to be companions. Why is it so? So the question for me is, I would say, where do we draw the line if we start to open up the borders of sexuality? Again, I understand that that's going to be a never ending conversation. Sure. So what I go back to is my Rabb and my Nabi, Aisatu Salam, told me that this is not the way that humans were meant to live, designed to live, purpose that they are to live by. And I trust them.
Yeah.
And I may not know why.
Yeah.
But part of trust is that when you don't know, you trust that they know.
Yeah.
And you're going to roll with that. So that's actually a very interesting conversation. So moving, you mentioned kind of, you know, because I know we're kind of bordering on towards the conclusion of the show, the episode. You mentioned her name, Linda Sarsour.
I wanted to say one particular thing.
Okay.
I was having a really fascinating conversation, you know, with a visit, one of the scholars who's visiting us, teaching at the seminary, Sheikh Weiss from the UK.
Also known as Qalandar Tabrizi.
Well, allegedly.
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 Sure. The artist formerly known as.
Please to refrain. Please. But so we were having a really interesting conversation, and he brought up this little historical kind of example. And I'm going to just, again, the Hangout's a place where we just kind of talk, so whatever. Jamaat Islami, Maulana Maududi, Rahimullah Ta'ala, and Jamaat Islami, kind of the effort that he started, a reformist movement in the subcontinent that became very politically active and involved. During the 80s, there was like all this legal action taken against them, and they were being really vilified and demonized, and they were all these bans were being placed on them. Kind of take a look at the Ikhwan in Egypt.
Yeah.
And
So basically, it was a group that was trying to make religion more political.
Yes.
Or politics more religious, you should say. And then there were a group who, you know, secularism, they believe that religion and politics should be separate.
Right.
So they were kind of like reacting to that.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. We're not advocating either one.
Neither one.
We're just saying this is history. This is history.
Yeah, historical fact. So this happened. So this one religious reform kind of movement that was becoming more politically active, there were all these sanctions and restrictions being placed on them from the government. So, and what that leads to, and some people might not be fully understanding the scope of that, even though we should start to understand the scope of that even here. But basically in the East, that gets really, really dicey. and all types of lines of decency and rights and humanity become blurred instantaneously. Like, they will murder these people in the streets, and they'll persecute them and jail them without trial, without conviction, without evidence, just pure suspicion. So it gets really nasty. People are destroyed, their families are destroyed, etc. So that was happening. And at that time, some traditional scholars, like a small group, some traditional scholars released and published a critique of the leader of the movement, Maulana Maududi, Sheikh Maududi, rahimullah. There was a critique of some of his philosophies and his methodology that was written 20 years ago.
So you'd call it like an academic critique?
It was an academic critique written 20 years ago, before they were being politically persecuted, and decided to release it and publish it at that time. And there were other senior scholars who basically spoke up and said that this was the most cowardly, most unethical, cowardly thing that anyone could have done. And the scholar, when the senior scholars who said that this was the most cowardly thing I've ever seen anyone ever do, he himself philosophically also disagreed with the movement.
That's amazing.
But he said, this is not the time when we do this. There will be a time and a place where we will go inside of a library, we'll sit in an academic setting, mm-hmm. and we'll have a very academic, professional discussion about our, you know, differences of viewpoints and opinions just, and evidences and methodology.
Just like the Companions of the Prophet did.
As Absolutely. Said,
that there is a room, not just there is room, there by design. You know, the amount of tashahud in the masjid of the Prophet, the amount of difference.
Absolutely.
There is, by design, you know, it's one of the mercies, actually, yes. in this religion, is that not everyone has the uniformity and identity. It's all been approved, and the religion has space for this. So there is time for you and I to sit in a library
sure.
and discuss why we disagree.
Right. But right now, when your brothers and sisters, their doors are being kicked in, and they're being dragged off to prison, and they're being persecuted, now's not the time when you talk about, we disagree with them as well. That's cowardly of you to do that.
So you're really feeling this.
Oh, which yeah.
You're lit right now.
Absolutely.
Woke. But so sister, who are we talking about?
Anybody.
But who's the catalyst for this?
Right now, Sister Linda, the Islamophobes are coming after her full, you know, all baring their teeth. They're coming after her.
Because she was one of the organizers for the Women's March that we were talking about. Yeah.
So they came after her, calling her everything from a terrorist to an ISIS sympathizer to et cetera, et cetera. They're coming after her nasty.
Mm-hmm.
They made memes out of her. They wrote articles against her. They did news pieces on her. They're polluting her mentions on Twitter with nasty type of slander and stuff. And we're just going to defend her right now.
Yeah, there's no room for saying we're going to conditionally defend her.
No. And all this stuff like, but I disagreed with this one stance that she took this one time 3 years. Nobody cares. You be quiet. You're a coward. Stop it right now. Nobody cares. Nobody wants to hear your critique. And that's not to stunt like academic discussions. Have your academic discussions, you know, 6 months later inside of a library.
You know what's so interesting is that academics, a lot of times academics you know, they proffer this idea that wisdom is so important, that knowledge and wisdom, and we can't just act brashly, we have to think. But the definition of wisdom, according to what you and I have studied, is putting things in their right place at the right time.
Yes. Well, the Urshayfi Mahalihi.
Exactly. Everything in its right place and its yes. right time. And it's interesting because right now is not the right place
no.
or time
no.
to tear into Linda Sarsour
for a
valid difference of opinion. If
yeah.
look, she's allowed to have her differences
yes.
and we are allowed to. It doesn't remove her from any fold of faith or anything like
no.
that. And that what that means by definition is that when it comes time to defend,
yeah.
it is time to defend. When
Absolutely.
It comes time to discuss, we fly Sister Linda in, we give her a platform to give a lecture to our community about the importance of being active and being a servant of humanity. We take her out for dinner or for breakfast, and we start asking her, can you explain to us your perspective on these things? Because my perspective is a little bit different. I just want to know what you think and why you think that way so that I can maybe learn.
Yeah.
And here's what I'm thinking. Maybe we can come to, you know, come to some point where we understand maybe a difference, or we disagree, or we agree.
Right.
But right now on Twitter is not the time to do that.
No. And see, I even contend the idea of saying like, oh, but this is just like my academic viewpoint. There's nothing more academic than the Quran. There's nothing more intelligent than the Quran. You might see yourself as some philosopher, but you're just a two-bit commentator if the Quran does not dictate your philosophy.
Yes, he's talking to you.
We try not to get too nerdy in these discussions, but innamal mu'minuna ikhwa, the word ikhwa is the word used for actual biological siblings. Mm-hmm. The word ikhwan is used more figuratively for ikhwan ash-shayateen, like the brothers of Satan. But ikhwa actually means biological siblings. Not all believers are not biological siblings, otherwise nobody could ever get married. But
boom.
But it's borrowing the word for biological siblings, saying your allegiance and your loyalty to your Muslim brothers and sisters need to be like that of your allegiance and your loyalty to your own blood siblings.
Or even more.
Even more.
Like faith brings us together where blood doesn't.
Where it doesn't. The son of Nuh, alayhi salam.
Yeah.
Innahu laysa min ahlik.
Yeah.
Sorry, he's not family no more.
Yeah.
All right? And we were giving that silly example. We were talking about it, how me and Abdullah might be fighting, my younger brother, my sibling, right? Fighting, I do it in quotation marks because I would destroy him. But me and him.
That was really mature, by the way, that you had to throw that in.
So that me and him might be like fighting, like physically, like wrestling over the recliner in the living room. Okay. I'm like, no, I'm sitting on the recliner. He's like, no, I'm sitting. And we might be going at each other. And then all of a sudden somebody comes in from outside. And if somebody attacked Abdullah from outside, I would tear that person to shreds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because like, no, you don't lay a hand on my brother.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And right now people are attacking our sister, and that's all I care about.
And I think it also goes to be said that like, if someone was truly academic and truly, you know, like a student of knowledge, let's say, when you and I read Aqidat Tahawiyah, both times actually you mentioned this, I remember, is that you said that, look at how minimal the requirements of being a brother or sister are.
Absolutely.
Like Imam Tahawi, again, Egyptian Hanafi, shout out. He basically says that the person has to believe in God as messenger and pray towards the Qibla.
That's right.
Meaning pray towards Mecca. If a person does that, it doesn't matter what they believe, meaning that that doesn't push them outside that fold.
No,
it's not heavy enough to push them out. Those three things are heavier than anything they could do.
And now I owe that person.
And now that person has rights on me.
Yes.
And one of those rights is to be there for them.
Yes.
You know, one of those rights is to support them. We can figure out all of our differences later.
Absolutely.
It is very hurtful to see, you know, even in private discussions, it's hurtful to see people bring it up right now. It's just not the time. It's not the place. And I think that people need to, if you have a disagreement with like a movement or an idea, that's fine. But you can also articulate that without using Linda as an example.
Absolutely.
If Linda, you know, if she claims to be part of a movement, again, this is all hypothetical. I don't know if she actually did or didn't. But if she claims to be part of a movement that you disagree with, go ahead and write a post about how you disagree with the movement that, you know, your 47 Twitter followers are going to read about. But you don't ever bring up someone's name.
No.
And this is actually from the manners and etiquettes of difference of opinion.
Yes.
Is that you never personalize it.
Right.
You never make it a personal issue.
Read Adab al-Ikhtilaf. And if you can't read Arabic, Sheikh Muhammad Awama wrote this book called Adab al-Ikhtilaf. And if you can't read Arabic, which is okay, we're all students, we're all learning, then find a scholar and say you'd like for them to go through this book, Adab al-Ikhtilaf, the etiquette of disagreement with you.
Yeah. And one of the beautiful things about the Muslim Ummah is that everyone's doing something that's so necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm doing something, Sheikh's doing something. Neither one of what we're doing is quote unquote more important.
No.
Linda's doing something, Sheikh's doing something, you're doing something. All of the things we're doing, as long as we're doing something, are important.
Correct.
Don't fall in the trap of trying to undercut what someone else is doing as long as they're doing something. The Absolutely. Only criticism we have is, are you doing something?
Right.
You know, if you're feeding the poor and I'm teaching Islamic study, or and you're teaching Islamic studies, someone else is feeding the poor, I'm working with college kids, all of that work is very important. What Linda's doing is essential. Mm. What Hassan Shibli at CARE is doing is essential. Mm. What all these people are, what Noman is doing at Baina is essential. What Absolutely. You're doing here is essential. Let's just all pat each other on the back and motivate one another.
Yes.
Instead of trying to tear into each other and make everyone just like me, right? Because that's not going to happen. So we may as well just go ahead, take the L on that 1 or 2% of difference and push each other 98% of the way.
Wow.
You know, I'm good. Hey, A is good for me. A minus, A, you know, 95% of agreement is good for me, as long as we agree on those three things. Yeah, and I think, and I hope that, inshallah, people who are listening to this who did voice disagreements with Sister Linda, you do the right thing, and you delete those comments, you delete those tweets. If you're in groups on WhatsApp, if you're in group, anything that you said, just go back and try to go ahead and clarify and take it back, and even mention what Sheikh said, which is that this is not the time for this. You know, right now is the time to defend. And once I get a chance to meet Sister Linda, also a little pro tip, it's never good to voice disagreements over the internet. Twitter is perhaps the worst place to discuss disagreements. So go ahead and pick up the phone, call the person, talk to them, be as human as possible, inshallah. And hopefully, we can stand together in these times, because that's really, really what this whole episode is about, is being able to stand together, even with people that we disagree with, whether it's someone we disagree with outside of our faith or someone inside of our community, our faith community, being able to stand with them and support what ultimately Allah Ta'ala and His Messenger want as they've instructed for us. So, Shaykh Abdul Nasir, with that, we're sitting at just over an hour now, so I wanted to go ahead and conclude because I don't want people to fall asleep too quickly. But thank you so much, Jazakallah Khairan, for your thoughts as always. And for those of you who are listening, inshallah, stay tuned, stay connected to us, subscribe to the podcast, follow us on Twitter, Qalam Institute, on Instagram, and inshallah, you'll be kept up to date with all the things that we're doing, not just the hangout, but everything else that's going on here. Inshallah, that could hopefully serve you and help you and your family. Absolutely. And any needs. Jazakumullah khairan, everybody. Make sure to hang out with us every Thursday morning, maybe Friday morning. We'll see. On the Qalam Hangout. Assalamu alaikum.